welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde. She's Erica Barnett. He's Sandeep Kashyap. And let's get right to it. The biggest, the baddest, the most exciting topic I think we've ever had on our plates here at Seattle Nice. Bruce Harrell's big budget is out this week. We've also had some response from council. There's some tension, the usual conflict, everything you're looking for in an episode of Seattle Nice. Erica, just to catch people up who, you know, aren't accountants, who don't do a lot of budgetary line item work themselves, who aren't budget reporters like you are, who aren't experts, we have this massive budget, like $7.4 billion overall, but that's not what we're debating, right?
Right. So the budget for the city is around $7.4 billion, or the proposed budget is. Most of that is capital projects and things that can't really change year over year. So the budget, when people talk about it and debate it, is really the general fund and operating budget primarily. So that is $1.6 billion, more or less, year after year. That is what all the debate is about. That is where things can change. And that's what Bruce Harrell has proposed and that the council is getting ready to start chopping away at.
And you know, typically I've done some reporting on this and I've noticed like when it comes down to the final vote, sometimes the council will be arguing over like $500,000 over a $1.6 billion budget. And there'll be sort of, you know, vicious battles back and forth over that $500,000. I mean, how does that even happen? Like, are they really that close together ultimately?
Yeah, well, a lot of those $500,000 projects, I mean, there's one project that's being cut that's $26,000 in this year's budget that I think might end up being controversial. I mean, it's because, you know, you're talking about small programs that are near and dear to council members' hearts. And, you know, $500,000 could be, you know, the city's no longer supporting this program and it has to lay off half its staff. So that's kind of where those battles come down to. I mean, we do have district city council members, so they have projects that are in their districts. So it's just, you know, it's just a matter of like individual program level stuff when it comes down to that point.
I know we wanted to talk about Jumpstart at the Jump. So before we get into that, Erica, why don't you just tell us what is Jumpstart before we talk about what's up for debate?
Yeah, that is a payroll tax on the largest employers in Seattle and on the wages of the highest paid workers at those employers. So Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook. I mean, I'm sort of speculating here because we don't know exactly, you know, how much these companies pay, but basically the biggest companies. And it goes to, or it is supposed to go to, some discrete specific purposes, equitable development, Green New Deal, housing, and small businesses. Now, for the last couple of years, the tax passed right before the recession, right before COVID. And so for the last couple of years, it's been used, you know, largely to fill a giant general fund budget shortfall. And so the issue, once again, this year is that the mayor, Bruce Harrell, wants to use it wants to change the law to allow himself to use it for non-Jumpstart purposes. So that's kind of the broad outlines of the debate and the use of that tax.
Okay, Sandeep, I want to get you into this conversation. What do you think about the burgeoning debate over the tax formerly known as Amazon? I realize it's not actually the Amazon tax, but the tax that at one time, a similar tax was called the Amazon tax, a similar tax proposal, I should say, well, the Amazon tax. What do you think?
From Shama Sawant. Yeah, there was
actually Mike McGinn, you know, originally. But yeah.
What was right?
Candidate
her
Mike
version
McGinn.
Of the fuck Amazon tax. I can't quite remember. Wasn't it?
I think KUW coined the phrase. I'm just saying right here. But
yeah. It just rolls off the tongue. The fuck Amazon tax.
Seriously, so, KUW. I think coined the phrase. Doesn't get credit, yeah, but I'm pretty sure.
Was it you at KUW?
Yes, yeah. the first to describe Mike McGinn's proposal as the Amazon tax may well have been.
What I'd say is this: is there's a debate brewing at the council about the ongoing deficit projections that the city faces, right? And what the mayor is saying is, hey, we passed this really substantial new tax fairly recently. And yeah, it was ostensibly earmarked for all of this new spending on cool, new, shiny, new stuff. We're going to spend all this money for that. But in the meantime, we're facing really, you know, a really significant budget deficit. As Erica has pointed out, the projections show that deficit is going to continue on, and maybe according to the projections, the most recent projections get larger. And so the mayor's saying, well, we ought to be using this revenue from this new tax to backfill the big budget hole in our existing programs and spending. And I think that's going to be the fight at the council. I think Teresa Mosqueda, the architect of Jumpstart, is going to pushed back on that, or at least it's made some noises about pushing back on that. I guess the question would be, if they are going to earmark the jumpstart for entirely new spending, then what are they going to do to deal with the deficit? Because there doesn't seem to be an alternative proposal on the table.
Well, it's not just that if they're going to earmark it, they actually, you know, after Jenny Durkin did this year after year, this very thing that Bruce Harrell is proposing to do to sort of raid the jumpstart tax because it's new money, they passed legislation specifically last year, specifically saying that we have a jumpstart tax fund and the money in this fund cannot be spent for any other purpose unless the general fund falls below a certain amount, which is around $1.5 billion. Bruce Harrell wants to essentially overturn that law that just passed and say, you know, and peg it to inflation and say, actually, whenever it, you know, increases by inflation by this much, we can take money out of jumpstart. So it's not just like a feeling that they wanted to spend it on shiny new stuff. The entire purpose of the tax was to spend it on housing, equitable development, Green New Deal, and small businesses.
Shiny new stuff.
Well, I mean, you can call it shiny new stuff, or you can call it, you know, housing for homeless people. And by the way, another thing that Harrell has proposed doing with the jumpstart tax is changing, while he's changing that legislation to let mayors rate it in perpetuity, he has also proposed allowing the housing part of that tax be spent for higher income people. Right now it's for very low income and homeless people. And this would allow it for people making about double what it's currently allowed for. So it's not just that they will have to, you know, have a debate over it. They'll have to overturn their own legislation and pass new legislation saying we didn't mean it 1 year ago when we said, you know, we were really serious about this. So it's going to be a significant debate.
It is going to be a significant debate. It would not be – I don't know what's going to – the outcome of that debate is going to be. It wouldn't be the first time that the Seattle City Council made a whole bunch of commitments that they couldn't keep, right? Like, say, defunding the police by 50%.
Which they never immediately legislated jumps on. To mind. So very, very different situation.
But they committed to seven of them.
It's not in Seattle publicly. It's not in Seattle Municipal Code, and this is.
Right. So, yes, they passed a law saying you can't spend this money on anything but what we stipulate in this law. But then I think it's going to be incumbent on the council. How are they going to fill the budget hole for, you know, kind of existing programs and spend it? And I know that the mayor, and we've talked about this in the past, that the mayor's talked about has expressed, I think, new openness to raising taxes, right? And they're talking about convening a progressive revenue task force. But as they've said, even if and or when they do that, they're not going to see actual revenues from an increased tax for a couple years.
I mean, one place they could cut.
So what happens in the
interim? One place they could cut conceivably or even just start talking about is some of those long, long vacant positions at SPD. I mean, Bruce Harrell has said he wants to get SPD up to 1,450 officers. Right now it's well under 1,000. That seems wholly unrealistic, at least in the short term. And so why not abrogate some of those positions and free up that money? Instead, Harrell has proposed some savings within SPD, but most of that, yeah, except for about $11 million, is going to go right back into SPD's budget.
Elections have consequences, right? You know, I think the concept of first of all, he is, yeah, sweeping some of those empty positions, but he is using it for other public safety spending. I think that's something that
– Well, for hiring bonuses among other things.
Well, right, to add more costs, which is something the broad majority of the public in Seattle supports. We adjudicated this in the last election. The you know, semi-abolitionist candidate got her ass kicked, to put it bluntly. You know, so there you go. Like Bruce is following through, the mayor is following through on the commitments he made on the campaign trail that he's
well,
gonna,
I don't think one of his commitments was
he's going to increase funding.
I don't think one of his commitments was specifically to allow tons and tons of long vacant, unfillable positions, positions that are unfillable, certainly, you know, in the next few years, to just sit there and be funded. And I think that's something that the city, you know, rarely ever looks at. We just keep funding vacant positions in perpetuity. And I, you know, I think that's when we're talking about, you know, everybody needs to make sacrifices. You know, it shouldn't always just be homeless service providers, for example, or human services providers who Harrell is proposing to, you know, impose an effective wage cut on.
Erica, I know you've been doing a ton of reporting on this. Wages for homeless services providers possibly on the chopping block. Harrell, unsympathetic to increases that would be, more reflective of the cost of living. And it could well be that some of our biggest supporters here on this podcast actually work for those homeless services providers. So let's not give them short shrift here. What have you been reporting? What's the conflict? What's the debate about?
Yeah. So speaking of recent legislation, there is a law in the books that says that human services contracts that the city pays for have to increase by the rate of inflation. And the intent of that law, which Bruce Harrell voted for in 2019, is to basically ensure that people don't suffer, real wage losses as inflation increases year after year. At the time, Harrell actually added an amendment that said specifically that this was to be, a law for all times, for times of prosperity as well as times of austerity and times of downturns. And now that he's mayor during a downturn, he's proposing to essentially not overturn, but revise that law so that it is the wage increases are permanently capped at 4%. So the mandatory amount the city would have to pay would be 4% forever, no matter what the rate of inflation is. And that amounts to an effective cut for human service providers and for the wages that they make this year.
This is one where I'm sympathetic to the position that Erica laid out in the piece that you wrote at Publicola, which is that at a time of 8.7% inflation, to only give a 4% cost of living adjustment in the human services contract seems to me to not be a good thing. Look, I mean, and I should preface here again, as I've said in the past, I am on the board of DESC, which is one of the largest homeless shelter and housing providers in the state. And so I'm familiar with these issues. And what I can tell you is that the people who do that work in particular at DESC for very difficult work for very low pay. And so if you are in effect cutting their salaries by not even giving them anything approaching the cost of living when their salaries are already really low, that seems like a real problem to me. It's hard enough already for those organizations like DESC or Plymouth or the major homeless organizations to attract people to and then retain them to work there to do the work, right? And there are opportunities right now for lots of these organizations to expand. And the real constraint is they can't find the people to do, to hire to do the work. It's a real challenge, and this would make it worse. So I do think this is a problematic.
Well, proposal. And the thing is, I mean, we talk all the time, and I'm going to bring this back to cops just very briefly. We talk all the time, and we're paying, potentially huge bonuses, $30,000 to police officers to come onto the force, because there is a both a recruiting and a retention problem in the police department. There's a huge recruiting and retention problem within the human services field as well. And it has been around, I would say, longer than the problem with police, because human services workers have historically been very underpaid. And so, you're looking at the top five homeless service providers have 300 vacancies that they can't fill right now. And then people come in. It's really hard work, as Sandeep said. They get underpaid and they leave. And so you don't have any institutional knowledge. You have institutional knowledge, but you lose it very quickly at these organizations. And so, I think we need to start thinking about these folks as, not just frontline workers, but emergency service workers in the same way that police are, in the same way that fire are, in the same way that EMS is. And we don't treat them like the emergency service workers we are. We treat them with, kind of disdain and disrespect, and we treat their ability to earn a living as a disposable line item in the budget, while providing these huge bonuses for cops. And so, without getting into the whether those bonuses are worthwhile, or whether expanding the police force as much as Harrell wants to is a good idea, I think these folks are on the chopping block year after year after year. And I think it's just it's really telling that Harrell has had a complete reversal of heart in the last 3 years from when he was very, very in favor of ensuring that they had a a COLA every year.
Well, I think you are. I mean, again, I think you are going there, right? When you bring up the sort of cop bonuses, you're going there, right? And so I'm, like I just said, I'm super sympathetic to the argument that this is a bad move in the mayor's proposed budget and that this is an unfair devaluation of compensation for already underpaid, overworked people in these industries. I'm not super sympathetic when the left has this reflexive need to tie that to the efforts that are underway to rebuild Seattle's police force, right? After the 400 plus departures that have happened over the last couple of years, I think that should be a priority. I think most of the public thinks rebuilding Seattle's police force should be a priority. And if the bonuses are going to help make that happen, then do the damn bonuses. But that said, I'm sympathetic to the argument that that doesn't mean we should then be like, you know, cutting the pay for the folks who are also doing important work on the social service side, right? So, but the tinge of what you were just saying, and I hear this from the left in Seattle all the time, is again wanting to re-adjudicate the, you know, oh, the bloated SVD, let's cut SVD.
I didn't say any of those things, though, Sandeep. I said we need to think of these folks as emergency service frontline workers, which they are, and we don't. I mean, people making, you know, $20 an hour, $25 an hour, you know, are eligible for many of the programs that they are, you know, signing people up for. And so, I mean, I think that the delta between, you know, a police officer making $120,000 a year and getting a $30,000 bonus plus overtime on top of that, and a human services worker making, you know, $20-$25 an hour and having to live in, you know, Tacoma and commute into Seattle is very big. And so I don't think it's irrelevant to talk about, you know, the fact that we provide some emergency service workers very little and some emergency service workers very much. And, you know, should we be closing that delta? I don't know. I mean, should DESC be paying people $20-$25 an hour? Or do you think it, you know, would be good to maybe increase that and allow them to actually retain some of their workers? Because, I mean, working for DESC, from everything I understand, is very, very difficult because they deal with challenging people all day long. And that's just one organization.
Yep. Right. And yes. And like I said, I agree that those workers are underpaid and do a difficult job, and we should be working on trying to raise their salaries. I'm just objecting to the kind of knee-jerk, like, oh, cops.
Yeah, and you're having an argument with, like, some fantasy
anyway,
on Twitter.
I think we mostly agree.
All right, let's move on to another topic, part of this larger budget discussion that we're having and that the city's going to be having for some time. King County homelessness funding. This has been an issue. It's also an issue in the budget. Erica, what's at stake here?
So the King County Homelessness Authority has, you know, asked the city and the county, which are their only funders, to give it, in addition to its existing budget, about $90 million for what Sandeep would call shiny new programs. They didn't get it. The city, Harrell's proposal anyway, provides $10 million more, and it specifies that it has to be spent on, you know, these specific kinds of programs, tiny houses, shelter, you know, et cetera, which is not really what KCRHA was envisioning. They had a whole program and plan, including provider wages, which is not in here. And then the county also did not substantially step up. So basically what that means is that their budget is going to stay essentially flat, if not even decline a little bit, depending on what gets adopted, in terms of, you know, just with inflation and everything, and cost of living increases. So basically it was, if it was a referendum on the KCRHA and its budget, the city essentially voted no, or Bruce Harrell essentially voted no. Now we'll see what the council does. But again, you know, Harrell, as a member of the homelessness body's governing board, voted for the budget with a lot of reservations. And Lisa Herbold, who's also on that board, voted for it. So the $90 million increase. So, but this is where the rubber hits the road, and the city is basically saying, or Bruce Harrell is basically saying, you know, we don't have a lot of confidence that spending more money on KCRHA this year will produce, you know, incredible results. So it hamstrings the KCRHA, basically.
I don't understand where the $90 million is supposed to come from, right? Weren't we just talking about the fact that the city's got a big, big budget hole, right, just to maintain existing services? And so the fact that the mayor proposed to you know, essentially, it was an increase in funding, but you're right, inflation is high and there are other, you know, increasing costs. So I'll accept your characterization that it's essentially keeping their funding, you know, flat.
I mean, I'm combining right? that with the county a little bit. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know the exact
Ballpark.
It's not a
big increase, right? It's not a big increase. But at a time when there's a big budget hole, I think that's significant, especially when, you know, there was a kerfuffle a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about on the podcast where the you know, mayor was expressing some frustration and making some noises about potentially reducing funding for the Regional Homelessness Authority. That's not happening here in any way, shape, or form, really. The other thing that is interesting that you put your finger on, Erica, is that they're specifying where they want that new money to get spent, right? And it is on things like tiny homes, which is something that Mark Doan, the head of the Homelessness Authority, has been skeptical about, to put it mildly, but I think it's something that some of the council members think is a high priority. And Andrew Lewis immediately comes to mind as a major champion of tiny homes. And so I think it's an interesting play on the part of Mayor Harrell to specify what the new funding is going to go for the Regional Homelessness Authority, and to particularly specify some of the priorities that key council members have, right? Essentially privilege their priorities maybe over what the Regional Homeless Authority itself had.
Well, I mean, this is sort of the fundamental tension, I think, and you know, a reason to have argued against the formation of this authority is that the city still wants all this control over it. And, you know, and understandably so, I suppose, since they provide the majority of the funding. But, you know, at the same time, what I think that KCRHA and Mark Doan's, the CEO, have pointed out is like, we can't actually make a visible dent in homelessness if we're not going to fund it. And I agree with you. Where is this money going to come from? I mean, I'm sure there are places that one could find in the budget, but, you know, it is essentially saying we still want control over this. We still want things to be the way that they were before we formed this authority. We want to, you know, be able to dictate to a separate regional authority how it spends its money. And I think that is, you know, whether you agree with the tiny houses as a priority or not, I think that is a problem for the autonomy of, you know, the Regional Homelessness Authority. And I will say, I mean, you know, the mayor's budget also includes a lot of money for encampment cleanups, for, you know, vastly, vastly expanding this unified care team, which does encampment removals, and for stuff like, I mean, the word graffiti, my God, it appears like 35 times in the budget. I mean, just kind of an obsession with graffiti. And so, you know, so there's a lot of like city beautiful, like let's make the city clean and shiny, you know, again, and the way it used to be, I guess. And I think that is in, you know, that is in stark contrast to this idea that we don't really need to spend much more money actually, you know, providing shelter for people living on the streets, providing services, providing the treatment that Harrell always says that the city provides, which is inaccurate. And so I think budgets are lists of priorities. And I think Harrell's priorities for homelessness are let's keep removing encampments. Let's really expand. They're expanding the RV cleanup squads. And they're also expanding trash pickups. And then a ton of stuff having to do with graffiti for whatever reason. I mean, there is more graffiti in the city. Well, it is visible. I'm not saying that's not real.
There is a lot more graffiti in the city.
But it feels like an obsession when you read the budget.
Well, I was just going to say I was walking down the street in Pioneer Square recently in broad daylight, like on the out in front of the Lion Building. You know, like the whole side of that building is covered with graffiti, and there was a guy with his cans, like in the middle of the day, like spray painting huge new graffiti on the side of this building and, you know, doing it apparently like, you know, in broad daylight with impunity, right? And so there is some of that going on. I kind of noticed it and it was like,
Was he tagging or was it a big mural?
Obviously, we know that it is,
Was he?
Yeah, and it was not pretty graffiti, right? But we know that Erica, you know as well as I do that this is a kind of a, for lack of a better term, a pet peeve of the mayor's, right?
So Sandeep, he's kind of like a proponent of the broken windows theory, this 80s James Q. Wilson theory that Rudy Giuliani and William Bratton in New York adopted. And it's kind of like, you know, if you allow squeegee guys to continue to operate as they did at that time, generally homeless folks who would spray kind of some not so great stuff on your window so that you give them a buck to go away, I think was the annoyance for the commuters coming in from Connecticut, New Jersey. And Giuliani said this kind of lawlessness, if we remove this kind of lawlessness from our streets, that will overall create like a better sense of order and actually reduce crime. Turns out, like, I think people later felt like the crime rates weren't so linked to what Giuliani was actually doing. But I mean, is the Harrell administration, the Diaz administration, kind of reviving the broken windows theory, do you think, by focusing on things like graffiti?
No, I think that's a really strained and provocative way to put
good.
It, you know,
good.
I mean,
yeah, is okay. It,
does the mayor have some concern about the, you know, outward physical appearance of the city and wants to try to clean it up and make it better? Is that a broken windows theory thing? I mean, I think that's just kind of normal, like, you know, civic upkeep and maintenance, right? I mean, I don't think he's saying, like, let's go out there and bust squeegee guys and like throw them in Rikers Island or whatever Giuliani was proposing. So I think that's kind of a stretch to turn like some graffiti cleanup efforts into some sort of like, you know, right wing plan to, you know,
I don't know. What is the, I mean, the question is, what's the criminology and the theory sort of behind it? Why the focus on broken windows? It might be that there's a lively debate happening that I just don't know about. So I'm not necessarily casting aspersions here just because I'm bringing up Giuliani, yeah, and William Bratton. I'm saying, does, yeah, Harold, does the police department believe that having graffiti left unattended creates a sense of lawlessness and disorder, as you're always, what's the phrase you usually use, that really does, you know, somehow lead to more crime? You're saying you don't think so, or, but you don't really know.
I'm saying it's a stretch.
It's a stretch because you have no idea. You basically have no idea. Okay.
Well,
that's fine. I'll ask Bruce Harrell.
Yeah.
So yeah. I just want to say, yeah, that, you know, there is a pet peeve of mine in the city, akin to graffiti, that I find to be a horrible visual blight. And it is all these goddamn eco blocks sprouting up everywhere. They are all over the city. They're in my neighborhood. If you drive down to, you know, South Park or Georgetown or anywhere, there's so many of them. They take up parking spaces. And strangely, the city not only does not seem to be doing anything about that. I talked to a woman who was living in a bus that got towed away. She lived in her bus for many years. And she said, as they were towing away the, you know, three or four RVs that were there, the business owners were coming in and setting up the blocks like as every RV disappeared, and the city wasn't doing anything about it. So I would like to see, you know, some action on that blight. And I didn't see anything in the budget about that.
So, Erica, you're anti-ecology. These are ecology blocks, and you're pro environmental destruction. I don't understand.
Yeah, it's funny. They're called eco blocks because they're like detritus from concrete production that would ordinarily just be thrown away. And they can be used for like walls and stuff. But I mean, in the city, they're like an anti-homeless. It's a homeless prevention device. I don't know. It's part of the plan that, like, if you just make it so that homeless people can't be anywhere, that they'll vaporize. It's the magical thinking plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd call it a plea for help and an indication that the last 2 years of the city's like policies have been a failure. It's not just like business owners that are dropping ego blocks. It's actually city departments that dropped ego blocks because they can't operate.
It's primarily
their
business
freaking
owners, though.
Right, but City Light has done it. Some other city agencies have done it because they can't operate their freaking facilities.
Well, the difference between random business owners coming in and terrorizing RV dwellers out of neighborhoods is that that's illegal. Uh-huh. And it is, it is against the law for them to do that. And the city looks the other way, and there are just thousands and thousands of them everywhere. So,
it's interesting that these things are, you know, concrete blocks are used. I mean, I was just back east, and you see a lot more of them there used as like counterterrorism barriers, right? They were put up after 9/11 to protect government buildings. You see some of that here, and now they're being used to protect us from RVs and homeless folks. Sandeep, you support that?
It's an inescapable reality of the situation regarding street level encampments and RV homelessness in the city of Seattle.
The city spends almost nothing on RVs. I don't love them either, on actually helping people in RVs. Well, the amount of the budget that goes specifically to people in large vehicles is dust. I mean, it's budget dust.
And this is something that's bugged me for a while. I know the city has tried to do kind of RV, you know, lots before, and they attempted it under former Mayor Ed Murray. It turned out to be, and I'm still not 100% sure why it's so freaking expensive and so hard to do. But there really does need to be progress on more efforts directed at RVs, or we are going to see more eco blocks proliferate around.
Well, one reason it's so expensive, I mean, the city,
whether you like
the
it
city
or not,
is, I mean, we are getting an RV park, supposedly by, you know, run by Lehigh. And the problem, I mean, I think for a lot of people is like those parks are not permanent. They are, you know, you have to commit to giving up your RV, accepting all these services and moving out. And a lot of folks who are, I mean, there are different, you know, sort of levels of, you know, a function among people living in RVs. And there's a lot of high functioning people that, you know, just want to live in their bus and can't afford an apartment and don't want to go live, you know, in a tiny house village. And
there are also a lot of people running chop shops.
Like I said, there are different levels. I didn't say there weren't. So, but I think that people do tend to focus obsessively on the people who are running.
I think a lot of those people don't want to move either, because they're like, I don't want to be.
You're changing the subject so that you can make it like the horror story. I mean, you know, it's like people who are against a bail reform pointing to the one, you know, person who got out and killed somebody. Yeah. So you're, but what I'm saying is like one reason those are so expensive is they're incredibly resource intensive. They have a ton of wraparound services, and that's great for some people. But, you know, there is no such thing as like a place where people who own RVs that, you know, maybe run or maybe don't run, but the people don't need all those services can go. We don't have trailer parks in the city of Seattle. And I think if we did, you know, that would be a lot of folks would live there.
I've got an unrelated anecdote I want to share, which is I was out for a stroll last night and there was this RV that had cardboard all over it and like duct tape and wire just like holding the RV together. I mean, the RV itself was like literally like falling apart. But then attached to it was this really nice boat with a bimini top. And I was like, who the hell owns this thing? And who owns this? It was just like such a weird thing. So that's an unrelated anecdote. I just want to get back to the concrete barriers, though. I'm obsessed with that issue. Yeah. Sandeep, it's like on the one hand, you know, you want this place to feel less lawless. Doesn't it create kind of a war zone atmosphere in the city that doesn't allow the city to really recover? I mean, these things, how does that represent a solution? You're saying it's an act of desperation.
It's not a solution.
But doesn't it contribute to the very problem in some ways that you're worried about, where it's like people arrive here and they're like, man, this looks like a freaking war zone.
As I said at the beginning, I'm not saying it's a solution. I'm saying it's a cry for help. You know, does it contribute to the sense that the city, you know, is in some kind of decline? I think so. Yeah, I think Erica's right about that. I think they are unsightly and indicative of a kind of massive failure on our collective failure on all of our parts to address the homelessness problem. I'm not a fan of ego blocks by any means, but I'm also saying that the reason they're getting dropped all over the place is because having rows of like RVs where certain activities are going on that are highly, you know, disruptive or problematic, or, you know, whether it's drug dealing or other sorts of criminal activity that are happening around these RVs or around places of businesses, is also, you know, a huge, assault on people's sense of you know, kind of well-being and quality of life in the city. So neither of the, you know, I'm with Erica. I wish there was more effort being put into what to do about RV issues.
Well, and I think to bring it back to the budget, I mean, you know, whatever you think of the KCRHA and whether their, you know, 90 million requests was reasonable or unreasonable, when you keep the budget for homelessness flat while, you know, while increasing the funding for sweeps, you are explicitly not solving the problem. And, you know, and in fact are, you know, you're contributing to more eco blocks while not providing the solution. And if you think of this as a cry for help, I would hope that it's a cry for help that, you know, people actually have places to be, people actually have places to live, and not a cry for help that, you know, we just don't want this unsightly thing in front of us. I suspect in a lot of cases it's the latter, but I mean, let's take it as a cry for help and let's actually fund some of this, you know, some of the actual solutions to homelessness, which we are not doing in this budget. And so I think it's really important that that we keep that sort of, you know, that perspective in mind. The budget does fund some homelessness programs, but I would say not at any scale relative to the need.
Well, our wish list and our desires, at least right now, far outstrip our capacity.
It's all a matter of priorities. We have a $1.6 billion budget. And so plus, you know, however much from Jumpstart. And I would say within that $1.6 billion, we can prioritize. And to say like we have no capacity for increases is not true. I mean, we do. It's just a matter of, you know, budgets are fungible to some extent. It's a matter of priorities.
I've said it before. I would take that useless, useless is putting it too strongly, but the money, the $30 million is just sitting there in a bucket for participatory budgeting at a time of budget crisis and spend it on stuff we ought to be, you know, that are direct relevant needs. And of course, we're not going to do that for various political reasons, but there you go.
That's it for another scintillating edition of Seattle Nice, the budget edition. If you want to donate, and thanks to everybody who's been doing it, you can go to our Patreon account. If you want to communicate with us, you can tweet at us, you can direct message us at Twitter. It's Real Seattle Nice at Twitter. And thank you, everybody, so much for listening.